Oh, here's me. I want to get one of these. That's sharp.
Great. There's also some nuts over there if you want to maybe just pass those around. And the whole, you know, the mixed nuts theme is, of course, a welcome to all madness around the world. Everybody's a little bit crazy, I'm sure. Even the people who think they're not crazy are probably exhibiting some kind of craziness by saying so.
Thank you.
And Crazy Talks has been operating now since February. And it's been totally done without any funding from a university or a mental health agency. So this is a totally public arena or space. And we pride ourselves on that because we want to just kind of get people talking outside of the usual health contexts, research contexts. But tonight we have somebody who is a scholar himself and is probably going to be presenting us with some ideas that have ebbed and flowed through the academy, but have found their way here, back to the public. So I guess I should just mention that we're going to let Richard talk for about half an hour to get us kind of thinking. Thank you. And once Richard invites us into this conversation, we're free to share the space. And of course, we're going to co-create this space together, so just try to give a little bit of room to people who might be a bit shy. Of course, throw in your comments. It's welcome to have your comments in here and to make sure that you get a chance to just say. And we'll stay up until 8:30, after which we can just kind of hang for a bit if you like to while we clean up. And yeah, this happens every first Tuesday of the month. And so I'm going to just ask Richard if you have anything to introduce yourself with. Should we introduce you? I've known you for a few years now. You know, we're friends and we've done some activism together. You've invited me out to Van, and now here you are in TO via Skype. I can't really give you a great introduction, but please feel free to say something about how you come to us here today.
Thank you, Eric. So, I just want to do some technical stuff to begin with. So, I just want to do some technical checks to begin with. I've got my text bar open at the right, and I want to make sure that I'm speaking loud enough and clear enough so that you can hear.
You are?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you. And I'm going to be just glancing at the text bar every now and then, so if you want to make comments to that effect about volume, clarity, then please do, or anything that needs to be clarified, please do. Okay. And so I'll do an introduction. As Eric said, I was in Toronto in 2007, and I was at Ryerson University in the School of Disability Studies. And while I was in the School of Disability Studies, I began to think about, mad studies, about whether mad people might claim their own space in within universities, within colleges, for study, as a way of insisting on the fact that we've been excluded. When I finished my year at Ryerson, I was not able to find a job, and this gave me an opportunity to do some thinking and writing, and I got really into that, very excited, and I am a person who gets excited about ideas, and sometimes excited to the extent that it pushes me over the brink. And that's what happened in the spring and summer of that year, of 2008, and I ended up being taken by relatives to the Clark Institutes, who relatives who decided that I was not making what they called good decisions. And I had a stay there, given the usual antipsychotics and so on, and came out in what I felt was a worse state than before I'd been in. I abandoned my attempts to stay in Toronto and moved back to Vancouver in 2009 and began working in 2010 at Simon Fraser University. It was while I was doing some research there that I came across the concept of sanism. So sanism is a term that was used by a doctor, a New York doctor, who used to do pro bono work for people who were in state mental institutions across the states. People would write in letters and appeal to him for help. And he would take their cases to the courts. And what he found is that judges would simply dismiss the cases out of hand. They deemed it unnecessary even to hear what somebody from a state mental institution would say. And it was while thinking about what was going on here that Morton Birnbaum, who'd been to school with an African-American activist who was very concerned with racism and sexism within the legal system, but within the country in general, her thinking about racism and sexism influenced him, and he thought he had the light bulb go on and thought there's something analogous happening to the people whose voices will not even be heard. The judges are saying, not only do we think what these people say is of little value, but they're simply not worth listening to in the first place. So this is a very serious form of oppression, and it's that to which Birnbaum gave the name sanism. Now, if we jump forward a bit to the 1960s, when the ex-patient psychiatric survivor movement is warming up in terms of its activism, then there was an interesting brushing up together of the activists alongside Birnbaum, and this happened at some of the hearings, I think, into when Kennedy was president and was enacting legislation to scale back the mass state institutions and what led towards decarceration, the letting of people out into communities, and a different type of psychiatry. So around that time, activists heard Birnbaum and Birnbaum's term sanism, but were not terribly impressed. And that's because Birnbaum had always fought for what he called a right to treatment. And of course, that doesn't go down very well with ex-patients who are concerned with forced treatment and think that anybody who's arguing for a right to treatment has to be basically on the other side. I think this was unfortunate, and it has led to a situation in which the term sanism was taken up a bit here and there, so that the term sane chauvinism was definitely being used in Vancouver in the early 70s, within the grassroots movement itself, from what I can tell from reading and talking to people, the term mentalism, that's Judy Chamberlain's term, was more influential. So it's only relatively recently, since the turn of the century, that the term Sainism has been reevaluated by people in the MAD movement, and I think that people have begun to see possibilities that were maybe overlooked in an earlier period. I'm just going to pause for a second. So I'm just going to focus on the term itself, Sainism. What was Sainism? Well, Birnbaum said that it was an irrational prejudice, against people called mentally ill. In other words, against the type of people who he was trying to represent in court. But there's, as Eric himself has pointed out in some of his work, there's a bit of a tangle going on here, because the term, if you define the term Sainism and by introducing terms like irrational and mental illness, then you're beginning to tie yourself in knots. So there was always a problem with Birnbaum's definition. I think that Birnbaum may have reflected on the encounter with psychiatric survivor activists in the 60s, and in the 70s he wrote an interesting paper in which, well, first he stated outright, all Sainists are bigots, which is clearly a very strong statement. He also said something that gestures forward to what's been happening more recently. He said that his own thinking about Sainism provided pointers, but the people who would really understand what Sainism was and what it did were people who were being oppressed by Sainism. In other words, people who he still referred to as the mentally ill. And I would say that is indeed what has happened. So recently we've seen activists call for anti-Sainist values, and they've taken up the work of one of the people who followed in Birnbaum's footsteps, Michael Perlin. So Michael Perlin is a lawyer in New York who's written extensively about Sainism and written about how Sainism permeates culture. So there's Sainism in academia, there's Sainism in the workplace, in housing, and so on and so on. Now that once we begin to talk about Sainism at that level, and to at the level where it is something that has extended throughout society, then I think what we're dealing with is an ideology. I'm now going to talk about what I mean by ideology. Now, when activists decide on an agenda, psychiatric survivor activists, it's often targeting medications, the adverse effects of medications, targeting forced treatment, electroshock, etc. And all of this is absolutely essential. It's targeting the things that are visible, that leave real scars on people. However, I'm somebody who believes in the value of theory. I think that everybody is a theorist. Everybody carries their own ideas as they're going about life, as they're practicing in the world. practicing politics, given that politics is an everyday activity. But that there is a need for people who focus on the theoretical side, and that's what I have leant towards throughout my life, and I've actually done it to the extent that my father once said about me that I was disappearing up my own arsehole. He's a Yorkshireman and tends to resort to that kind of expression at times. So, people from Yorkshire, Northern England, are very practical people and often quite dismissive of abstract thinking. So the fact that his son grew up to be somebody who thinks about theory a lot was something that, at that point at least, he was expressing skepticism towards. And activists often express similar forms of skepticism towards theorists. So you get the phrase, well, that's all very well in theory, but what about in practice? And I bear this in mind. These are all important criticisms of theory. It's important for people who do theory not to get involved in ideas for their own sake. I think that ideas have to remain rooted in what's going on, rooted in actual practices, that we have to remember the harm that is being done to people every day. So when I talk about sanism and post-sanism, is in relation to everything that activists are doing, and I'm trying to, through disentangling some of those knots of sanism with the rational, with the idea of the distinction between reason and madness. I'm trying to contribute to, I'm one of many people who's trying to contribute to providing ideas that will make activism more successful. So recently, what has happened, because of the way that Michael Perlin's work has influenced people in identifying this very large thing, sanism, is people have thought about, well, if we've got this, if we've got sanist practices everywhere we look around us, then what would it be like if we could reach a world without sanism, a world in which there was no longer prejudice of the sane towards people deemed insane, prejudice that's used to deny people housing, to deny people access to education, and so on and so on. And yes, that has to be the guiding question, I believe. How can we get to a world after sanism, just as we ask questions like how can we get to a world without racism, a world without colonialism, without sexism, and so on. And just as with racism, you get anti-racist struggles, with sanism, we've seen the formation of anti-sanist struggles. What I've begun to feel is some concern about this idea of the anti-sanist. I wonder whether what was identified as sanism in the 50s and 60s was already changing at that time. So at the time when Birnbaum was representing people in state mental institutions, there were hundreds of thousands of people in the United States and Canada locked up in institutions and kept there for very long periods of time.
Richard, we're having a little trouble with audio.
Turn your microphone back on so I can hear you.
We're just having a little bit of trouble with audio right now, so can you start again with that last thought, because I think that sputtering is probably wrong.
Okay, thanks for that. So, so I was just talking about going back to the time, the 1950s,
1960s. Sorry about this, but we're still getting that sound problem. So I'm going to just try to see if I can...
How's your back?
I'm going to try hanging up and calling you right back. How's that sound? Is that possible? Let me just try you again. Can you just say something now just to see if maybe it's clear?
Okay. Yep. How's that?
And it's still the same. Let me just call you right back, okay?
Yeah.
Sometimes the connection gets a little wonky.
Yeah. The connection and the battery. I have a USB cable that might help.
Okay, can you try saying something now?
Okay, how's that?
Perfect. Okay, so we'll just knock off that minute, and here we go. I'm going to turn off the microphone. You're on.
I was just talking about the 1950s and 60s, the point at which there were many questions being asked about the effectiveness of state mental institutions. What Morton Birnbaum was saying was that in some of the institutions, for example, there was one psychiatrist for 1,000 or 2,000 patients or inmates, as they're better described, which is preposterous. So it was taking up to 1 or even 2 years for somebody to be seen. In other words, not only was there no effective treatment, but there was basically no treatment at all. So Birnbaum's argument was that if nothing is being done, if people are simply being held in an institution, then there is no legal ground for them being kept there. And this was a pretty powerful argument that by the 1970s began to work in the legal context. But before that, it appears that other prerogatives led to the scaling back of large-scale institutions. Other pressures were at work, including economic pressures, and also very vocal criticism of psychiatry and the influence of psychiatric survivors and the influence of books and films like One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, which really ridiculed psychiatry. In fact, one of the big proponents today of psychiatry, Ephelia Torrey, who's always talking about the need for coercive treatment and is unfortunately quite influential, in the early 70s wrote a book, The Death of Psychiatry. So it was realized among many psychiatrists that psychiatry was in serious trouble, and that its status in society had fallen. Psychiatrists were not being taken seriously, and so psychiatry took a big change of direction. It's one that there is a brilliant book, a book that was published, There were a very small number of copies. It's called The White Shirts, and it's a series of essays, and it's published under the name Ellen Field, but I think the actual name of the author is Margaret Redfield. Those essays predict the current, or have accurately predicted, I think, the current situation. She made grave warnings about the fact that releasing people from institutions was not the solution that many people held it to be. In fact, psychiatry had something much more evil prepared. It was preparing to extend its reach beyond the asylum, beyond mental institutions, and to dip its claws deep into society. And that's what it's done. It now has an incredible range. You see psychiatrists giving evidence in court on all kinds of cases. You see psychiatrists in schools, the influence that they have in education, in the diagnosis of children with ADHD. You see the influence of psychiatrists in the workplace. Psychiatrists will willingly give their opinions on just about anything, on the arts, in culture, just about on immigration, just about anything. It's really quite extraordinary. And yet, if you look at it the other way around, how open is psychiatry to people from outside their discipline? It is one of the most closed disciplines within the university, within academia. To engage with a psychiatrist from outside the discipline, from another discipline, is very difficult, with all but a small minority of psychiatrists who will simply dismiss you as not being an expert. That's something I find a real paradox of our times. So this diagnosis of psychiatry extending its reach into society. There is a historical precedent for that, which is to go back to, if we go back to the 1920s and the attempt to overthrow capitalism. So this was successful in Russia with the Russian Revolution, but in European countries, Western European countries that saw what had happened in Russia, the nature of the state changed, and the state extended its reach into civil society. So it's the same, it's an echo of that happened in the 60s with psychiatry, which is part, clearly a branch of the state, reaching into society, reaching far into society, setting down roots in society. And that, I think, is the problem with anti-sanist practices, that psychiatry's reach, which we can call the reach of sanism, is so wide that to attempt to struggle against it head on is going to run into problems. Now, I'm going to turn to one analogy here, which is colonialism and the rise of nationalist movements. So nationalist movements in, say, many of the African countries, there was a wave of declarations of independence in the 1960s and 70s as African countries like Algeria, with following the 8-year war with France, achieved a degree of independence. But the important thing there is a degree of independence. They established themselves as independent states, and yet they had an elite within the state, within the nation state, which was very tied to the colonial power. So within many of the countries that were colonized by France, there was an elite that continued to control the country. And so there was an internal form of colonialism that persisted after the country had declared independence. And you can look at the same pattern with other colonizing powers, with England, with Spain, and so on. Holland, Belgium. Irving Goffman was another of the people, a sociologist, who identified the concept of stigma in his book Asylums. And this identification of the concept of stigma was part of this big historical sweep that led to the pressure to close the institutions. But what has anti-stigma become today? It is psychiatry that claims to be at the forefront of the struggle against stigma. It's just a total farce, and they've done that by turning stigma upside down. The concept of stigma
has
totally changed, so that now stigma is understood as...
Sorry, Richard, we're still having a little bit of audio trouble. Sorry, it might show up when your speech is a little faster. Pressured speech.
Okay.
I think your last point was that Irving Goffman's concept of stigma was being fought against by... now has become psychiatrists are fighting it, or pretending to fight it at least, and they're turning the concepts upside down because, of course, they don't have a clue. Could you just maybe end off on that and keep going? I think we have another 4 minutes or so until we open discussion. Yeah.
Right, so we'll basically wrap up now. So what I'm suggesting is that just as nationalist struggles against colonial powers only achieved a certain degree of freedom from colonial powers, so that we now have the term neocolonialism, we also have post-colonialism, and these terms describe continuing forms of colonialism that don't require occupation, that don't require countries to European powers and so on to have permanent forms of government installed directly in the country, and yet they continue to exercise great leverage over those countries. So what I would suggest is that a head-on struggle against Sainism, declaring a war against Sainism, and saying that what we need is anti-Sainist struggle, that there are some potential problems there, because of the scale of Sainism, and more subtly, the way that reason works. That the fact that anything and everything can be stolen. The recovery movement has been stolen. The struggle against stigma has been stolen, has been taken up by psychiatry itself. And I'm just going to end with this, with a little prop. which I bought a snack, which I'm going to open after this talk, because I went out to the grocery store and I came across this. So it's Droppin' Mad Beats. So these are beet chips. But I was just fascinated that the marketing is includes the word mad. So the mad movement, I mean, is this a success that madness can be seen as a positive, or is it another example of appropriation of the endless commodification, the endless turning of terms from radical struggle into more marketing slogans? So thank you, I'll end there.
Turn the regular speaker back on over here for a moment. And once we've done that, we can get you on audio again. But you'll have to kind of give us a testing over here if you can, please. Can you just say something?
Okay.
Good.
Sure.
Thank you, Richard. That's all we need.
Can you bring the computer? Does it make
yeah, we'll bring the computer a little closer.
Down there?
And unfortunately, that's. We'll also stop the recording so that people can.